the history of John Monteith. Now let's start again. John, it was about this time, in the midst of all this foreign travel, that you were also developing much stronger links with the ODA.
Yes, I'd had informal connections with the ODA for quite a long time. And then, round about 1975, Bob Cunningham, whom I'd known for quite a long time, was one of their senior advisors, suggested to me that it might be possible to apply to tropical crops a kind of analysis of growth in relation to climatic factors that we'd been using on barley and wheat and sugar beet and other things at Sutton Bonington. And he encouraged me to put in an application to ODA for quite a substantial research grant. And this came to fruition in 1976, when we were able to appoint four research fellows and two technicians, as far as I remember. And the grant even allowed for me to work for ODA half-time, so half my salary was paid this way. And I started splitting my time between the university jobs in the morning and then the ODA in the afternoon. And as I had two different offices for this, it wasn't too difficult to do. The ODA office happened to be in an old staff house that we had occupied as a family when we first moved to Sutton Bonington, so I felt as if I was coming home there. And the first thing we had to do was to develop facilities for growing tropical crops in controlled environment conditions. I think, as far as I remember, that our remit was to look at cereals and legumes, and we decided, after I had made a visit to ICRISAT to discuss collaborative work, that if we could do some work on sorghum and groundnut at Sutton Bonington in a controlled environment system, then that could be complemented by fieldwork on these two species at ICRISAT, because they were in fact two of the ICRISAT's five mandate crops. And the idea was that we would get the detail of response to light and water and temperature and so on from the measurements at Sutton Bonington, and then look at the actual response to these and other environmental elements in the field in crops grown at ICRISAT.
And that group expanded slightly and then spent a number of years going backwards and forwards between the two places.
Yes, that's right. We had people going out almost every year for quite a long time to work with our counterparts at ICRISAT. And this really worked very well. And in the end of the day, I think we, over a period of 10 years or so, we published something of the order of 70 or 80 papers in the series. And one of our number, Jeff Squire, pooled the whole thing together in a very useful little book that you've probably seen. It was quite a challenging business trying to grow tropical species at Sutton Bonington, but we had good temperature control in our greenhouses. We using gas-fired heaters, and we had control of humidity using humidifiers, and laterally we were even able to measure carbon dioxide balance by injecting carbon dioxide and trying to maintain a constant concentration.
I suppose the unique feature about those houses was the way that you tried to grow realistic stands of crops,
yeah.
The way that most people don't use glass houses.
That's right. We felt it was important to simulate a reasonable sized plot in the field. The growing area was about 10 metres by 5 metres or so, which is not what micrometeorologists would regard as an acceptable size, but it's larger than many plots in agronomists' trials. And the philosophy was not to replicate it in the standard fashion of agricultural statisticians, but to look at response surfaces by having a range of temperatures, let's say, or a range of water supplies or something of that kind. And this really worked out quite well, aided, of course, very much by the field experience out in Ikrasat itself. And it's very gratifying to see that these glass houses are still in use. I was at Sutton Bonington only last week, and the control system has gone through a whole series of improvements over the years as new techniques became available for control, and they now have the whole thing just running on one PC with everything under control from one very small box, compared with the extremely cumbersome system that we started with in the early days when none of these solid-state devices were available.
So what were the main scientific directions that you took in that group?
Well, they really developed from the work that we'd done on temperate crops earlier on, looking at the response to individual weather elements, first of all, and then trying to put the whole thing together in terms of simple models of response to climatic factors. One of the first things we looked at was response to temperature, and tried to make a bit of more sense of all these ideas about so-called heat units that had been in the literature for a very long time, where you simply added up from day to day the number of degrees centigrade above some base temperature that had been determined empirically. And nobody quite knew why you did this, but it seemed to give fairly sensible answers in terms of time to germination or time to flowering or some kind of phenological stage like that. We discovered from some laboratory work, initially on germination, which is a relatively easy thing to quantify in terms of rates and durations, we discovered that if you took the time for, say, 50% of seeds in a batch to germinate, and plotted that against the temperature at which the germination occurred, you got extremely good straight lines from a temperature at which there was virtually no germination at all, right up to an optimum temperature, beyond which the rate started to get slower again. And when you looked at this, it fell out quite simply that the so-called heat units, or day degrees, were just the reciprocal of the slope of this straight line. And we started then to talk about thermal time rather than heat units or day degrees, because what we thought we were looking at was the way in which the plant's perception of time was modified by temperature. For warm-blooded animals, perception of time is virtually independent of external temperature, because our bodies run more or less at a constant temperature. But when you warm up a plant, it thinks that time is passing faster, and therefore it goes through its developmental processes more rapidly. And that was a rather anthropomorphic way of looking at things. But it works very well, not just for germination, but for processes like leaf expansion and time to flowering and so on. So that was the temperature bit. The radiation bit was simply the observation that in responding to radiation, the main determinant of, or rather the main discriminant of, differences in dry matter production by different stands of the same species is really in the amount of light that is intercepted by the canopy as a whole, and that you can get a fairly conservative index of response to radiation by measuring the intercepted radiation and the dry matter production, and working out the amount of dry matter produced per unit of intercepted radiation. And that's only an approximation, of course, but it is a quantity which seems to be remarkably conservative under many circumstances. And you can go on from that to look at the way in which that quantity is modified under conditions of stress. For example, we had one student who showed the way in which it was affected by level of application of nitrogen. It's also affected by water supply. And that gave us what we sometimes call a radiation use efficiency, although that's a rather sloppy term for a quantity that has dimensions of mass per unit of energy. But it's a quantity that is comparable to water use efficiency that people have used for a very long time. We looked at water use efficiency too, and we were particularly interested in the way in which that quantity depends on the saturation deficit of the atmosphere. And there were other ways in which saturation deficit came in as a variable that we'll talk about later on. But by breaking the climate down into these three or four major factors of temperature, saturation deficit, radiation, water, we were able to get a pretty simple but useful way of analysing how throughout the growth of a crop there were these responses to environmental factors.
While the ODA group was making all this progress, you didn't entirely lose touch with the sort of the larger scale outside atmosphere work, did you, into remote sensing about that time?
Yes, a little bit of remote sensing, and that followed on from the interest in light interception by canopies and the stability of the radiation use efficiency figure, because people were beginning to use the so-called normalized difference vegetation index, the ratio of reflected energy in two wave bands, to get a handle on the amount of vegetation present, seen by the satellite, which they then expressed in terms of a leaf area index. And it seemed to me that this was not rational, because when you've got a leaf area index much more than about one, a lot of the leaves are shaded, and what you're really measuring is not the total area of leaves per unit ground area, but the fraction of incident radiation that these leaves are intercepting. So it seemed very logical to have a look at the relation between the normalized difference vegetation index and the intercepted radiation. And we had Mahendra Kumar from Fiji as a PhD student who built a neat little system for measuring the vegetation index from reflected radiation, was able to make measurements of light interception in a stand of sugar beet, I think it was, and showed that you could indeed get a very good measure of light interception from the index. Now, I was pleased to discover not very long ago that the British Sugar Corporation is now using this technique on a regular basis every year, flying over fields of sugar beet in East Anglia and using the vegetation index to assess radiation interception, and from that to predict sugar beet yields in a way which apparently is very useful in terms of getting the market price right and estimating what deficit or surplus there is going to be. So it has had a practical application. And of course, the people who are concerned with natural vegetation, with forests and with grassland and other ecosystem types, have used the idea as well, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the links of you being here, actually, that tomorrow you're going to be talking to people who put that into use over forests.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say about it.
Now, also at this time, you were keeping your foreign travel going, weren't you, to Australia and New Zealand?
Yes, apart from the visits to ICRISAT that I've mentioned already, I was invited in 1979 to do a lecture tour of all the universities in New Zealand, starting from Auckland and going right down to Dunedin. Did that in about 6 weeks or so. That was very interesting to see what was happening there, and then I went on to Australia and paid a visit to one or two old friends, went right up the west coast, the east coast, as far as Townsville. And the following year, I got an opportunity of accompanying John Mason and John Horton to China. We were invited by the Chinese Scientific Academy and had about 3 weeks going around visiting research institutes in Beijing and Shanghai and other places. And that was very fascinating, of course. The only thing I regretted there was that the visits that were planned for me to agricultural research stations were almost all in towns, and I didn't get a chance of seeing what the agriculture was like out in the countryside at all.
And this was also the time that you were doing your presidency of the Royal Meteorological Society.
Yeah, that I think was 1979 and 1980. John Horton, who was previous president, asked me if I would be willing to do that, and I accepted a little apprehensively because I hadn't really been very involved in the affairs of the society or on the committee work for quite a long time. But there had been a whole succession of agricultural meteorologists as presidents over the previous century, and I felt that I had to do my stint in that role. I enjoyed it very much, and I really quite enjoyed the challenge of preparing the presidential addresses, which gives you a chance of stepping back and looking at your subject in pretty broad terms. And the first one naturally was on evaporation, which I tied up with surface temperature, and that of course links up now with quite a lot of the work that's been done in the remote sensing field attempting to use surface temperature to estimate evaporation rates, which I still think is a pretty hazardous business, and in a constant kind of climate you can make some progress with it. And then the second one was on climate and crop production, so these were fairly natural things to choose. As it happens, at the same time as I was president of the Royal Meteorological Society, I was a vice president of the British Ecological Society. Must have been a rather unusual combination.
What were the main features of, during your presidency in the society? Were the publications?
Yes, I think every president has at least one major issue to tackle during his presidency, and for me it was the taking on board of the Journal of Climatology. And that happened in a rather roundabout way. I had heard that John Wiley's was quite far advanced with plans to launch a Journal of Climatology under the editorship of Stan Gregory from the Geography Department at Leeds. And I was pretty concerned, and so was the committee, that this might compete with journals published by the Society, and that it would be much better if we could take it under the aegis of the Society without altering the links with John Wiley that Stan Gregory had already set up, and with Stan Gregory still as editor. I felt it would just make it a more comfortable arrangement. So I went up and saw Stan Gregory and in his department, and he was at first perhaps a little reluctant to go ahead in that route, but saw the virtue of it in terms of having a sound base within the society to operate from, and ways in which he could develop his editorial committee and ultimately hand over to somebody else. It is much easier to do that within a society than when you're just operating as an individual. So we took that on, and for the first year, of course, the journal made a bit of a loss, but I gather it is now flourishing. It seems to have no difficulty in getting good quality papers and is making quite a bit of money for the society, so that was a success. The other thing that I was anxious to get off the ground and only partly succeeded in was to establish links with some of the some of the meteorological societies in European countries, and I wrote to about 10 or 12 of them and got virtually no positive response in terms of forming any kind of active link, except from Greece. And the president of the Greek Meteorological Society at that time, John Dikiados, was very enthusiastic and suggested that we might have a joint meeting in Athens. And that did actually come off in the September, I think, of 1980, and it was followed the following year by a joint meeting in Oxford. And I don't think it continued after that. There just wasn't enough common ground, really, between the two societies to keep it going. But now that Britain and Europe are so much closer, I'm sure it's something that should be raised again. And I thought it was rather curious when I was at an AGM about a couple of years ago when somebody made this suggestion and nobody in the audience seemed to remember that it had already been attempted. So perhaps I should remind the current president that it's something that would be worth looking at.
In the last couple of weeks, as we're recording this, of course, the European Union is going to expand, bring in
yes,
new
indeed.
Countries with
yes.
strong meteorological
That's right.
That would be very interesting.
The Nordic countries would. Mm.
Now let's turn back a little bit to the Nottingham work, and we talked about the ODA group, but the other half of your time was still devoted to the environmental physics group. So what was happening there?
Yes, that's right. I was still involved with the department as a whole and with environmental physics as a whole. And what was happening there, of course, was very largely as a result of your interest in atmospheric pollution. And this is the point at which I think I turn the question round to you for a moment or two. We were talking earlier on about radiation and aerosol, and you hinted at that stage that your subsequent work on pollution really grew out of that. Is that the case?
Yes, it really all started when you and I were interested in the excesses at Aberport.
Yes.
And what was the source of this aerosol that was attenuating radiation over Britain? And the more I started reading about that, the more I began to read about the likelihood that sulfur was responsible for the formation of some of the aerosols that were very widely distributed on a global scale, causing solar radiation attenuation. Once I got interested in sulfur, I began to realize that just on our doorstep we had a major source of sulfur dioxide in a big power station on the River Trent. And then it was a bit of luck, really, that we just happened to have two pieces of technology in the department that led me into pollution, two sorts of pollution research. One was the diffusion pyrometer, which your group had been developing for partly for the Nuffield supported work, and the other was the flux gradient approach, which we were able to use to look at fluxes of sulfur dioxide. So both of them really led from the sort of instrumentation that the department had. And maybe we should say a bit more about the pyrometer.
Yes, that's right. I'd been interested in the diffusion pyrometer way back in Rothamsted days when we had a visit from Kees van Bavel, who had developed a very ingenious little device for clamping onto a leaf and blowing dry air through a small perspex chamber, then in measuring the rate at which the relative humidity increased, and that there was quite a clear, well-defined and reproducible relationship between that quantity and the diffusion resistance offered by the stomata. And while I was still at Rothamsted, I wrote a paper on the theory behind this, and one of my colleagues built a pyrometer that was an improvement on Van Bavel's one, and we went on making improvements at Rothamsted, in fact, and ultimately got the instrument taken over by Delta T Devices, whom I've had a long connection with, and who have manufactured, amongst other things, the tube cell riveters that we originally developed at Rothamsted. And they in turn have taken over the improvement of this, and the latest barometer, the AP4, is a beautifully instrumented, automated, state-of-the-art instrument, which is almost self-calibrating and goes far beyond anything that I ever did when I was involved with the technical side of things. And these have been sold now all around the world. And I was very pleased to find when I was at the meeting in Seattle last week that they were demonstrating the instrument there, and that Van Bavel, who has now joined forces with Delta T through his Dynamax firm, is back pushing the instrument which he was originally responsible for developing. Wheeler's come full circle.
Well, after that short commercial break, maybe we should talk about you having a short sabbatical break, one of those came along around about this time.
That's right. I could have had a sabbatical much earlier, and the reason for not taking one, of course, was largely domestic. But with five children, it's not all that easy to move around the world. But by 1984, the older members of the family were off our hands, and we managed, Elsa and I, to spend a most enjoyable year split between Ikrasat and, by way of complete contrast, the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And I had about 5 months at Ikrasat working on some aspects of crop modeling, which I didn't take further until I went back full-time on the Ikrasat staff. And then I moved to Maryland and worked with Robert Gowney and Bhaskar Chowdhury on various aspects of evaporation modeling, and interacted a little bit with people like Sam Goward from the Geography Department of the University of Maryland, who were interested in the relation between radiation interception and then DVI, which I've mentioned already. We also had a chance to travel around a bit to visit other places in the United States, Connecticut, for example, and Madison. And there was a meeting of the agricultural branch or section of the American Meteorological Society while I was there in Phoenix, which I was invited to go to, and met there a lot of people whose names I had known for many years in the literature, and that was a very stimulating occasion, after which we went on and did a bit of sightseeing in the Grand Canyon and in San Francisco.
So in the autumn of 85, you came back from that sabbatical, and I've often wondered if you still had itchy feet after after all that travel in view of what happened next.
Well, yes and no. I greatly enjoyed the freedom of the sabbatic leave and the fact that I could settle down for days at a time and just think about research matters. But we were very, very much at home in Sutton Bonington. We had a lot of friends there in the village and in the Methodist church that we'd attended for many years. I, every Christmas time, got the students together to form a little choir, and we sang carols to the people from the village who came up for the occasion. And there were all sorts of nice things like that that we would have been very sorry to leave behind. But what happened eventually was that one day, I think in December 1986, I got a phone call from the director of ICRISAT, Les Swindale, who happened to be passing through London at the time, who told me that there was a vacancy for a position as director of the resource management program at ICRISAT, and he wondered whether I would be interested in applying. And this job had been advertised, and because I hadn't been thinking at all about moving away, I never looked at the advertisement or thought about it. And my immediate reaction was to say, no, I'm not interested. But instead I said, well, give me a little time to think about it. And I went home and I talked to Elsa about it, and we thought very hard and prayed about it, and decided in the end that I should explore the possibility. So, to cut a long story short, I went out to ICRISAT in the January of 1987 and was interviewed and found to have passed necessary tests, and eventually left Nottingham in the summer of 87 and started then in the autumn.
That must have been a very different life that you were moving to. No academic teaching links anymore. Did you have a whole group to build up, or were you taking over a group that was established?
No, I was taking over an established group. The resource management program had been formed about a couple of years previously by bringing together people from the different disciplines that make up resources. There were the physical resources of atmosphere and soil, so we had physicists and chemists involved in that. Then there were the biological resources of crops and cropping systems, and finally the human resources that the economists looked after. So it was an even broader spectrum of disciplines than I'd been accustomed to dealing with before, and quite a big challenge.
How did you organise the science? I mean, did you get some totally new science programmes going to bridge those disciplines?
Yes, we attempted to do that. It wasn't possible to go right across the whole spread of disciplines, but one of the things that I got running the second year, I think it was, that I was there, was a very major experiment on sorghum, looking at the interaction of water and nitrogen application. And that, of course, involved soil physics, soil chemistry, crop physiology, and agricultural meteorology as well. And because we had 6 levels of nitrogen and 2 levels of water, and measurements of virtually everything every week, in addition to daily climatological measurements, we got a vast amount of information, and some of it quite unique in terms of the root system, for example, which we were able to look at in great detail because of the abundance of junior staff there who sat for days on end for about 6 months washing out the roots and then measuring them on a delta T light table to get the root lengths. It has taken a very long time to get all that work assimilated and written up, but I'm just completing the first 2 papers now from that series of measurements.
Is it possible to sort of summarise, I mean, where the science moved on through that sort of study, from where you were with the previous ODA group analysis?
Yes, in the ODA group we hadn't really done very much on nitrogen responses. It was mainly at optimal levels of nitrogen application. And what this latest study has shown very clearly is the way in which, if you have abundant water, the main effect of nitrogen is on the leaf area development and therefore on the light interception, and that the efficiency of conversion is not much affected by nitrogen until you get down to very low levels. On the other hand, if water is in very short supply, there's a completely different story, where there is an optimum application for maximum radiation use efficiency. If you put on less nitrogen than that, the leaves haven't got enough chlorophyll, and if you put on more nitrogen than that, you run out of water before the grains start filling. So it's a very tricky kind of balance, and there's a lot more work to be done in that area.
And a lot of ways of applying that in terms of distributing the nitrogen in response to some aspects of water availability.
The other interesting feature is the conservatism of the water use efficiency, which is shown up in other studies, and I'm trying to do that on a more fundamental level at the moment by looking at the ratio of the internal to the effective ratio of the internal to external CO2 concentration. It seems to be coming out quite well.
As part of this job, John, you didn't just oversee experimental work going on in India, did you? You had other responsibilities.
Yes, I should make it clear that the mandate for the Institute was to work in the semi-arid tropics as a whole, and not just in the Indian subcontinent. So we had other outstations, notably quite a large one in Niger, and others in East and Central Africa, in Kenya and Zimbabwe. And I did quite a lot of travelling to these places during my time at ICRISAT, linking up particularly with the agrometeorologists in Niger, who were working in a very much harsher environment than we were in Hyderabad, with the low and very uncertain and erratic rainfall of the Sahelian region, and very, very light sandy soils, which were hardly held any water at all, so crop production levels were way down on the figures that we were accustomed to see in India. I was also involved in work in Ethiopia. We had a sister institute there called ILCA, which is the International Livestock Center for Africa, which was providing a base for some work on the management of vertisols, the deep black soil, which covers quite a part bit of the Indian Deccan and also the Ethiopian highlands. And one of my staff from ICRISAT was seconded to ILCA for a while to work with the Ethiopian National Service on vertisol management, set up a number of experiments there. And that was a very interesting place to visit too. And the last occasion when I visited was after the uprising and overthrow of the Mengistu government, and we travelled out to some of the country areas where the village streets and some of the fields were just littered with burned out army equipment and tanks of children clumbering all over them. It was the most extraordinary business.
Another aspect of this new job in ICRISAT must have been the scale of the management that you needed. I mean, suddenly you were going from a rather small group at Nottingham to what, 200 staff or more? Was that a problem?
Yes, it was 200 or more, about 230, I think. But there was a fairly strong management structure in position before I went there, and well-defined chains of command. Nevertheless, the buck ultimately stopped at my desk when anything went wrong. And within a few weeks of my going to ICRISAT, one of my colleagues and I were sent to a management training course at which there were 16 people from institutes like that put up at a nice chateau in a quiet village in Holland, and more or less incarcerated for 3 weeks when we were analysed and brainwashed. And did all sorts of kind of role playing and with video recording. You know the kind of thing, so you've done it yourself. But the thing that was most useful out of that was a personality test using a thing called the Myers-Briggs Index, which I think is based on Jungian analysis or something of that kind, where you had to fill in a very long questionnaire asking questions about yourself and what you would do under different circumstances and so on. And then they told you what your personality type was. And there were 16 different possibilities. That there were four different categories which could be either A or B. And it turned out from this that nearly all managers were in a particular group. I was in the almost diametrically opposed group, and therefore appeared on the face of it to be totally unsuitable for management, but not unsuitable for scientific research, I was relieved to find. And the, if I can remember now what the my attributes were, the first of them was the comparison between introvert and extrovert. And there I was pretty well middle of the road, but just slightly on the introvert side of things, not too much so. And then the next one was the balance between intuition, people who work with intuition, and people who work with reasoning. And there I was astonishingly right over at the far end of the intuitive scale. And so I realized that for a lot of my life, without really realizing it, I'd been making forward steps intuitively rather than in any rational way. And that was quite reassuring because it encouraged me to go on doing that, feeling that it had worked in the past, therefore there was no reason why it shouldn't work in the future. And then the next one was between feeling and responding to situations by feeling or by thinking. And there I was definitely on the feeling side of things. And the final one was between the people who like to get things wrapped up and finished and people who like to kind of drift along and see where the tide takes them. And there, fortunately, I was in the first category. Because if I had been in the second category, I don't think I could ever have been a scientist at all. I mean, some of the other attributes were definitely contraindicated, but the getting things wrapped up and finished off was the thing that possibly saved me from being a complete disaster as a scientist.
Publishers, yes. Yeah. The intuition one is very interesting, because I used to find that devastating, that I would work for weeks on something and take it in and show it to you, and you would say, well, you know, it probably works like this. Go away and think about it. And it usually did.
Really?
Yes.